So I'm going to call together, call to order this interim hearing. And we are, our purpose today is to gain information and insight about the experience in Minneapolis to start with, ranked choice voting that they conducted their 2009 election under by a vote of the people in a charter change, and then also I'm particularly interested in it because now we have another one of our major cities that passed a similar charter amendment to conduct their city elections with ranked choice voting. So we invited the city of Minneapolis, in particular Mr. O'Connor, who was the interim director of elections and worked for the city to conduct this election, and then retired once again. So he is retired. And then we have the city of Minneapolis had contracted with Dr. Wagner and Dr. Robinson to conduct an analysis of sorts to benefit the city of Minneapolis, and I think we will find it interesting as well. They are professors at the St. Cloud University. And then we invited Mr. Maida, the city clerk of Minnetonka, to come and talk to us about the electronic poll book pilot project. And at the end, we'll have just a brief presentation of the of Senate File 1820, which is a bill that addresses statutory changes with regard to any city, charter city or county that takes up ranked choice voting. So we will begin with Mr. Ranieri, if you want to come forward as well, from the city of Minneapolis, and Mr. O'Connor, and then we'll move into presentation from Dr. Wagner's and Robinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Director for the city of Minneapolis, and I'm very pleased today to introduce Pat O'Connor, who has been a public employee and for Hennepin County and an interim county administrator throughout Minnesota, and who was hired by the city to fill a position by a vacancy in our elections and help put together the IRV process that we went through this year. And Mr. O'Connor has, as you say, Madam Chair, has recently retired again, and I think he told me this is it, so he's going to be retired. So I'd like to turn it over to Mr. O'Connor to speak, and thank you.
Thank you, Gino.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. O'Connor. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
I will. My name is Patrick O'Connor, retired former Hennepin County Auditor-Treasurer, and for 6.5 months, interim election director for the city of Minneapolis.
Okay, and we're pleased to have your testimony, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Thank you for having me here today. I'll give you just a brief summary of our experience in Minneapolis. You may know that in 2006, there was an ordinance adopted that by the voters of Minneapolis that brought in ranked choice voting at the 2009 election. My predecessor, Cindy Reichert, spent quite a bit of time during the period from when the ordinance was passed until summer of last year investigating various types of ranked choice voting and learning how to best implement it in the city of Minneapolis. I came on board middle of June and frankly intrigued by this. I think once in every government person's career, a truly civic initiative of this magnitude comes along, and it doesn't matter whether or not you're for it or against it. To me, it was a very huge civic experiment that hadn't been tried in Minnesota, and I was very honored to be part of it. I was also honored to be part of a group of enormously skilled election officials in the city of Minneapolis, and they're sitting behind me, three of the four of them, just an outstanding group. And if the discussion gets very technical this morning, I will defer to them because they really have it down. We our initiative started with kind of three basic efforts once I came on board. One was we knew we had to hand count the ballots. And from a test election that was conducted in May, the time it took, we estimated that it would take to count the ballots was simply unacceptable. So we brought in a process redesign specialist. And I think the city of Minneapolis has come up with a wonderful way to hand count ballots on a timely basis. And in just a minute or two, I'll talk a little bit about things, kind of our wish list for the state of Minnesota. And one of them would speed up that hand count enormously. The second thing that we did was we wanted to know in the end how well was ranked choice voting received by the voters of Minneapolis and how well did we do administering it. And that's where St. Cloud State University gave us a wonderful proposal for a survey, and we went ahead with that. I guess there were four initiatives. The fourth one was simply preparing for an election. This is no small task, comes around most every year for cities, and that was something that we had to pay quite a bit of attention to as well. So those were our initiatives. We were all set up on election day. I think that, the fourth thing we did was education and outreach. Our goal was that before the voters went to the polls, every single one of them would know that voting this time in this municipal election would be a little bit different than in the past. And we were pleased to see, I think we made that mark pretty closely. The election day activities were pretty routine. We had low turnout, lower than we expected. A little less than 20% of the voters, registered voters in Minneapolis, showed up at the polls. I think this compared pretty closely to experience in St. Paul. So it became apparent to us that our use of ranked choice voting neither helped turnout nor hindered it. We just had a low turnout. It kind of confirmed what I think every election official knows. It's the nature of races that will indicate turnout. The hotter the race, the more people will come to the polls. So that was the experience in a nutshell. We were very pleased that by Thanksgiving, the count had finished. By early December, we had canvassed the final results. We had disassembled our counting center, which was our election warehouse, and sent everybody home. The last piece of information I wanted to give you today was there's a lot of talk about cost savings or extra costs with ranked choice voting. And I will tell you this much, as far as we know right now, if you separate the costs out, those costs that were one time only, such as our contract with St. Cloud State, our contract, for example, with the process redesign expert, separate those out and just look at those routine costs we could expect to incur with every municipal election using ranked choice voting, and offset that with savings from not having a primary. I think that Minneapolis did all right. I think they saved money.
What's the usual cost of a primary in the city of Minneapolis?
Madam Chair, I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $200,000 for a municipal.
Primary.
Yes, for a primary.
Or for any election? I mean, so what did a general election cost?
About the same.
So you're suggesting there was a no net loss or gain or whatever?
I think that realistically it's probably a wash, a break even. The one number that I did have before I left at the end of December was the hand count folks cost us $60,000.
And
that was the biggest expense.
And just to make it clear for all of us, the reason why the hand count is that there are no machine certified programs for conducting ranked choice voting. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
And are they in the offing?
Well, at this point, no. I think that it came as an encouragement to the city of Minneapolis that St. Paul adopted the ranked choice voting for a couple reasons. One is that, and I'd like to go into this a little bit further in a minute, but one is that we really would like state standards so that all of us who do ranked choice voting do it somewhat in sync with one another.
Well, we have this bill that would set that up, whether the standards or the procedures or the processes that are in it are the right ones, I think is up for discussion based on the experience of Minneapolis is the way I look at it. The bill is just as a starting point for what we should be offering statutory regulation if a charter city or county undertakes ranked choice voting in the future, they would understand, like St. Paul and Minneapolis didn't, I mean, because it wasn't there, that these are the conditions under which they can conduct those elections, and so they would have more informed voters when they went to the polls to make a charter amendment. So
that's correct. It would have been helpful to the city of Minneapolis had that happened before implementation. Absolutely. The second reason for the going together in seeking equipment with the city of St. Paul or Ramsey County is that for Hennepin and Ramsey together, their optical scan equipment is aging. I think Ramsey's is 12 years old now. Hennepin is 10 years old. The life expectancy of those units is somewhere in that vicinity. And so I have had informal discussions with Mr. Mansky in St. Paul about going in together to purchase equipment because arguably we could probably do a better deal, get a better price from a vendor moving on together.
Isn't it the case, however, that the Secretary of State has to approve of that?
That's right.
I mean, by statute?
Madam Chair, the Secretary of State needs to certify equipment, and we would hope that sometime in the next 4 years, and that's somewhat of our time frame now for both Minneapolis and St. Paul, there would be software certified for use in optical scan equipment that could handle both traditional elections and ranked choice voting elections, but we need that software certified.
In other localities across the country that use ranked choice voting, do they have a similar requirement that their equipment or their software be certified by their Secretary of State or their Chief Elections Officer for the state?
To my knowledge, none of the jurisdictions that have adopted ranked choice voting have required federal certification. They've been certified at the state level. So one option for the state of Minnesota might be to authorize our own Secretary of State to go ahead and do certification as other states do, or perhaps also to allow the Secretary of State to recognize other states' certification if their standards are up to our standards. And that would be one of our recommendations.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. O'Connor, you're saying they have software that works for the counting. It's just it hasn't been certified here. I mean, I don't know those other jurisdictions, whether they're using it, because when I've heard of them having ranked choice voting, I've never heard of them hand counting them. So they do have software.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, yes, they do have equipment. It's not our type, though. I think in San Francisco, for example, they use Sequoia Pacific. In other jurisdictions, they use a different one. I can't remember the name right now. For the moment, our vendors, ES&S, do not have the software available, but they would surely make it available if they thought they had a market the size of Hennepin and Ramsey County together, and that's why working together, I think, is so important right now.
Anything else? Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead.
Since we talked about a little bit about state standards, that's certainly something that we'd recommend, and as I indicated, that's something that we would have found very helpful going into this. We also talked just now about election equipment certification, and we certainly would support any initiative at the state level to speed things up and allow for state certification. It would appear right now at the federal level it's just not working right. I think it's been some years since the federal government has certified any election equipment. And I think it's important that Minnesota consider that we not be held hostage to that if we can maintain our high standards. The other thing that we recommend, certainly based on this election, is the difficulty that we had with write-in candidates. Now, write-in candidates in a traditional election is a problem, and that's been solved by Minnesota state law. For county, state, and federal offices to be a write-in candidate and have the vote counted, the write-in candidate has to register with the county auditor within 7 days of the election. That doesn't apply to municipal races, and I think it's important the state take a look at that. In ranked choice voting, as you know, the way Minneapolis set it up, the voters had three choices. And so you can imagine that just then tripled our problem with write-in votes. And for the most part, I'll just give you an example. I think it was in the mayoral race, we had well over 100 write-in votes for every single choice column. And each write-in vote has to be set up as a separate candidate and hand-counted. And so we get write-ins like Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and lizard people and things like that. But as election officials, we have to treat them seriously. And frankly, it's my estimate, and I'm not sure my good folks would agree with me, but I think that had we had something in place at the state level to put some limit on these frivolous write-in votes for municipal races, we could have completed the hand count within 7 days. And so I think it's something that I think is very important, and we certainly would ask the state legislature to consider. And it could be that some cities probably like it the way it is, because I know in a lot of rural towns, they occasionally will have a race where there's nobody running, and they have to have write-ins. And so maybe the law could simply state that this wouldn't be in effect in races where there were no candidates at all. So I think that could be dealt with.
Are your recommendations going to come to us in writing?
They certainly can.
Okay. I have them here. Good. I think we would appreciate that as we consider the legislation and or, as you know, Mr. Mansky and the city of St. Paul want to run their own show first and do not support any kind of state standards before St. Paul conducts its 2011 election. I'm not convinced of the wisdom of that position either, only to as a protection for voters. I mean, it should mean you vote one place, you shouldn't have to meet separate standards in another place to elect similarly placed public officials. That's the thing that worries me a bit about that. That would not cause litigation saying that someone's constitutional rights had been violated because they treated differently as a voter living in St. Paul or Minneapolis. I don't know what the wise solution to that is, but I do think it is a problem.
Madam Chair, I agree with you. I hope that there will come a point in time when Ramsey County and the City of Minneapolis can agree on standards. I'm fairly confident of that, having been part of St. Paul and Ramsey County for a couple of years after my retirement. I'm familiar with the operations over there. The last thing I would like to just put down here is that the City of Minneapolis certainly endorses legislation that would move the primary up. I think there'll be a proposal to move it up to August 10th, I think it is.
Correct.
That would be very helpful for us in election administration.
We're taking that up on February 5th, Friday, and hope to pass it to the floor. And it is a response to the MOVE Act, as you are well aware, the Overseas Voting Act that Congress passed in the Department of Defense bill.
That's good to hear. I guess if acceptable, I'll just close with a comment, and then if there's question, I'd be glad to answer them. I guess my last comment to this committee is that we as election officials don't endorse one type of voting over any other. And indeed, during this past election in the city of Minneapolis, our motto was, it is. It just is. Mm-hmm. It's not good. It's not bad. It just is. We were going to adopt the Nike slogan of just do it, but that was already taken. Our goal was to conduct this election administratively in such a way that the discussion can focus not on whether or not it can be administered accurately and appropriately and efficiently, but rather, is this the best way to capture voter intent? And I guess without sounding too arrogant about it, I think we accomplished that so that the discussion can then vote on capturing voter intent for the citizens of Minnesota. And with that, I thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Thank you for your service, not only to Minneapolis, but to Hennepin County. And you were one of my valued constituents. So
thank you.
Appreciate your service. Thank you very much. All right. But before you go, were there questions in particular for Mr. O'Connor? Okay. We will then proceed to a hearing from Dr. Wagner and Dr. Robinson on the evaluation, or I don't know if you call it evaluation, an analysis of the... the municipal elections in 2009. And gentlemen, no one on this committee has seen this report until we received copies of it today. So we probably need or at least paper copies of it. We need more explanation and review of it rather than less.
Sure. The city of Minneapolis.
I hope that you will direct us to pages in it as you're making points, would be helpful in our understanding.
Sure. Okay, Madam Chairperson and committee, we were asked to.
Sir, you need to say your name for
record. I'm Stephen Wagner, professor of political science and a faculty director of the St. Cloud State University Survey Research Center.
I'm David Robinson. I'm in the Statistics and Computer Networking Department at St. Cloud State, and I'm also with St. Cloud State Survey.
Dr. Robinson. Dr. Wagner.
Okay. The city of Minneapolis asked us to really do four surveys. A survey of voters in the election, survey of registered voters that did not vote. Many of the questions that we asked were similar. That were both telephone surveys, and a survey of election judges, about 10 questions of election judges, and about 10 questions approximately of candidates. The report that you received details the questions included near the end as the actual questionnaires. The front matter is discussion of us, the St. Cloud State, how we did the work, the methodology. For us, really, that's the most important part. We don't have a stake in the questions themselves, other than making sure that they're neutral and they were asked properly and that kind of thing. In terms of the telephone part, the survey of the voters, we took a what's called a random digit dial sample. Samples can be obtained a number of different ways for this sort of work. One could take it from a telephone book, a listed sample. They're generally out of date. Most of the companies that do that work update their telephone books about twice a year. Depends on where. Minnesota, about 30% of residents don't have listed numbers. California, it's about 60. It doesn't make a very good source of a random database. Could also use registered voters. Some places that works pretty well. It doesn't in Minnesota because people can register on the day of voting. And then we wouldn't know that. So we took a random digit dial, which is a computer-generated list, a large list of numbers, many of which don't really exist. They're screened by the company that we contract with to take out businesses, known not working numbers, that sort of thing. And then we're left with a large number of numbers to call. We started out with 16,000 and then wound up talking to, of course, far fewer of those. But it winds
Madam
up being...
Chair.
Senator Pappas.
If I could just interrupt quickly. Mm-hmm. Does that include cell phone numbers then, too? Would that be in the randomness of it?
It can be done either way. They can be excluded or they can be included. When telephone companies generate telephone numbers, they're done differently. So if we wanted just landlines, which was standard up until about a year and a half or 2 years ago, then we never got cell phones listed because they would take... a telephone, say a area code 651, then the prefix 493, that's a known landline, and then they make up the other four digits, and there's 100 in those blocks. This one, though, we did take a subsample of cell phones. We're finding now about 30% of households either only use a cell phone or they primarily use the cell phone. So in order to get a random sample, and our job is to capture 6 or 8 or 1,200, whatever we're looking to capture, respondents of the population to then infer back. We can't miss 30%, especially when we believe that they're about not entirely, but largely about under age 35.
Dr. Wagner, are people more likely to answer? Do you find their cell phones rather than their landlines at home?
They much prefer landlines. Yes.
Pardon?
They much prefer landlines.
I mean your respondents. Do people more typically answer their cell phones as opposed to answer their landlines? I mean,
Madam Chair, if I could answer that, we get a lower response rate from cell phones than we do from landline phones. And we found in Minneapolis, response rates were low, relatively low, compared to the rest of the state, as we found in other statewide surveys. Mm-hmm. The city of Minneapolis had lower response rates in both landline and cell phone categories. But typically, our experience is always that cell phone users give us a lower response rate than landline users.
We probably could talk about the way in which you go about doing surveys. I find it personally fascinating, but let's not spend too much time on this,
so
Senator Marty, but go ahead.
Sure. One real quick one, and that is I can see how you can measure city of Minneapolis for the landlines because the prefixes are probably follow city lines, but with cell phones, aren't you, if you're trying to call 100 cell phones, aren't two-thirds of them not in Minneapolis?
It is true, Senator. A higher percentage of the cell phone numbers that we get are not in Minneapolis. It's still targeted fairly well by the group we work with is Survey Sampling International, and they target by the 1,000 blocks and 100 banks. So Dr. Wagner mentioned you have your area code and the prefix, and then actually the first two digits form what's called a 100 bank, and those can be somewhat localized depending on where people got their cell phone originally. Okay. And so if it is entirely possible and very common for someone to have gotten their cell phone in Minneapolis but not live in Minneapolis, and so that does generate quite a few that are not eligible then for the survey.
Okay. My cell phone has a 612 prefix. My home phone has a 763 prefix. strange phenomenon started happening to me in December, in that I started getting robocalls from the city of Minneapolis telling me that I couldn't park during a snow emergency. And just wanting to know, Mr. Ranieri, you might want to take my phone off of that list. I have no intention of driving downtown and parking on a street and getting towed. And of course, in New Hope, you can't park on the street at all. So we already know that. But it's that, and I don't know why they're calling my home phone, which is a 763 prefix, if they rather than my cell phone. But I strange things happen with that.
If I may continue, there's a quite a bit of screening before we ever ask a question, you know, did you vote in the last election, mm-hmm. or whatever the first substantive question is. There's quite a bit of screening. And because the cell phones, for example, when we took the 612, and I have the same situation, I have a 612 cell phone but live in 651 landline, it was likely that both you and I could have been in the sample, but one of the first questions that we would have been asked really is this a good time? Are you driving or doing something where you would like us to call back? And if they say yes, then we call back. But the next would be then, do you live in the city of Minneapolis? And are you 18 years of age? Because we only talk to adults. And with the landlines, it's a very similar screening process because it was taken 612, but there's a little overlap over the city limits. So we had to ask once again, are you a resident, registered voter, that sort of thing. There's quite a bit of the screening process. The more screening, then the response rate will actually decrease. With the cell phones in particular, you know, because they're always within reach, then there's even more screening and more lack of response because, again, someone's checking out at the grocery store driving or they still have their phone on when they shouldn't be perhaps in this room. We did back in terms of the summary of the methodology. In terms of the phone survey component, we wound up talking to 1,200 individuals, all registered voters. A little bit more than half, almost 700, were individuals that said that they voted, and then a little bit more than 500 were registered voters that did not vote. Many of the questions that we asked the two groups of respondents were the same, and we can highlight those results. We also weighted once again. We wanted to mirror in our sample the population, so inference would be better. And we found that we had to wait quite a bit, really, because of the under age 35 voter, hard to get a hold of, and they don't vote as quite often as a 55-year-old potential voter. In terms of the voters. Almost all voted in person. There were not many absentee voters. Two sets of questions, really. The first set of question, I think the city of Minneapolis wanted us to ask, was how well did their information flow go? Did the voters know what they would be doing when they arrived at the polls? Where did they get that information? That sort of thing. That's probably the evaluative part. Did they do the job that they needed to do? As they would normally do to inform voters, of the folks that voted, about 80% knew that they were going to rank the candidates when they arrived to cast their ballots. We also asked that question of the non-voters but registered voters, if they knew that this election would be one that required them to rank their ballots, and that was about half. So it dropped a bit. We asked also where did they get their information about the process, and I think most often newspapers, television. I think the least cited source was the website for the city. Neighbors, friends, that sort of thing. Very common set of where one gathers information. And there was really no difference between voters and non-voters. We asked how well they understood ranked choice voting before they arrived, we asked that as a perfectly well or a fairly well option, and about half said they understood it perfectly well. About almost another half said fairly well. So most of the voters seemed to know what they were walking into and how to proceed. We asked how helpful were the election judges. Again, that's the value to get at the training. And about 40% said that election judges were very helpful, and about the same percent helpful. So, again, pretty high. We did ask, did they rank their votes, when, their choices when they did? And over half, but not much over half, about six of 10, 60% said that they did rank. We then followed up, was it easy or difficult to rank? And about almost all said it was pretty simple process. Those that did not rank, we asked them why they didn't. As a follow-up, and they said various things. They didn't know enough about the candidates. They didn't find the candidates acceptable, and some indicated, of course, they wanted to give an advantage to a particular candidate. In terms of, do they prefer, I suppose, one of the set the first really of the set of questions about do you like this process? That was the second set. First one we asked, what do you prefer? Do you prefer the ranked choice or the traditional method? A plurality noted that they preferred ranked choice, about 40%. About 25% preferred traditional. Another 25% didn't really have a preference. And you always get some drop-off. These numbers never add up. There's always don't knows and don't cares, stuff like that. Were they confident? We asked about confident will the votes be tabulated? And that was, again, quite overwhelming. About 8 of 10 said that they were confident, very confident, somewhat confident, but confident that it would work properly, correctly. Should it be used in the future? About 60% or so of the voters said, as well as non-voters, said, yeah, it should be used in the future. Let's see here. There's nothing particularly different from the voters, the registered voters who didn't vote, and I think I mentioned those. In terms of the election judges, this is really more of an evaluative how did the process work from their perspective. I think almost all said that they felt that the training was whatever was done, and we had no part of that, of course. Whether it was excellent or pretty good, they felt fine about it. We asked them if they felt that the voters were knowledgeable about the ranked process, and about three quarters said yeah, that the folks knew what they were doing. They were asked questions, but it wasn't everybody asked how do you do this kind of thing at all. The city of Minneapolis was wondering if judges always have to answer questions and do other kinds of things during the day of an election. And they were wondering, the added effort, if there was added effort of ranked choice, would that make a difference? And the judges said it was fine. They had plenty of time to do both. In terms of the candidate survey, we asked just a handful of questions. A majority, six of 10, said think ranked choice voting should be used in the future. About half to 60%. We asked them various questions. Did it impact their candidacy, their campaign? What about the party, their strategy? About half said that they adjusted their strategy because of ranked choice voting. About half saw ranked choice voting as an advantage to their political party. And about half said that it positively impacted their campaign. They also were confident that about 70% were that the votes would be counted accurately. That was a recurring question that we wanted to get at. That's kind of a summary. The report, in addition, shows each question that we asked shows what we call a frequency table, which is the numbers what kinds of very helpful, somewhat helpful, that sort of thing, and we also then break it down just by simple percentages. When we had the data, we also did cross-tabulation analysis so that we could see, well, were there any differences between gender or income, age? We asked about a half a dozen demographic questions. We always do that, in part, that way we can look at Look, if there are differences, if we're interested in that, but I think for us, really, it's to see how our sample is. If everybody that we wind up talking to is a male over the age 60, we wouldn't have particularly good confidence in that data. But we had the kind of spread that we look for. That's a summary, Madam Chair.
Do you want to add anything, sir?
Dr. Wagner mentioned that we weighted the sample. It's kind of my role with this is to provide some statistical expertise with doing that. So we weighted it to match the Minneapolis population in gender, age, race of the respondent, as well as cell and landline usage. So those four areas were particularly important for us to match. In the raw sample, without the weighting, we were underrepresented in the younger age people, both voters and non-voters, and also underrepresented in non-white voters and non-voters, mm-hmm. and underrepresented in cell phone users. So the weighting that we did adjusted to the sample to make it representative then of the Minneapolis population. This is a standard statistical technique that is commonly done in surveys.
The questions for Dr. Robinson or Dr. Wagner? I asked mine first. Okay. What did you understand the goal of the survey to be?
I think there was, two goals, to see how the process worked and to see how the voters, what the opinion of the voters were of the process. So.
And not particularly from the data to make recommendations to the city of Minneapolis on any changes that they would undertake.
No, that would be up to them from the data. Yeah.
Just from the data. Yeah. So you were not, that was not part of your part of your contract to do that. It was just to present the data and to summarize it based on the questions that you asked. And did the city of Minneapolis participate in developing the questions, or how did you work with them in coming up with what questions to ask voters?
Sure, Madam Chair, Madam Chairperson. It's a very normal iterative process. For someone that wants to ask a series of questions, provide us either with questions that they've asked maybe previously or other cities in this case have asked, or just a list of ideas that they would like to get at, and then we take a stab, if it would, at the questions, email them back, they email back to us, we email back. Sometimes the collecting of the data is actually the easiest part. The hardest part is coming up with a good set of questions that in our case, our client, wants to ask, and that we can ask. Every now and then, and it wasn't the case with this survey at all. Every now and then, we'll get a series of questions that we just simply can't ask. That they're way too leading. I once saw a draft question. It was about drinking and driving, and the question was if something isn't done by the state, and it wasn't the state, by the state, then people will drink and drive, and your children will probably get killed on the highways. Do you agree or disagree that the blood alcohol level should be lowered? It's, that sort of leading kind of thing. We just can't do. So that's what we did, and we did that with the four components.
Politicians do that.
Politicians do that. I didn't say that.
Call it
Madam Chairperson.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a number of questions.
Fine.
And I think that they probably might bleed over between the report here and also some stuff from Mr. O'Connor as well, so you might I might ask if you could jump up there. I think it's very helpful to have some folks that actually did the administration of this and some of the political science folks here because we've had a hearing, and I'll just start by saying I understand that today instant runoff voting is not on trial here. We're not hearing the bill, and we're not going to be going into all of those arguments. But what's helpful, I think, is that when we did have that debate in this committee, and I'm sure we'll have it again, we had proponents of the system lay out some ideas, some claims, some hopes, some dreams, some thoughts about what they thought this was going to do to improve the system. And I think it's important that we've got some people that have now practiced this in the field and have studied this statistically, if we can try to see if we can verify any of those claims. The three claims that stuck out in my mind from testimony previously in our committee hearings was that this was going to improve voter turnout, that it would lead to less negative campaigning, and that it would be a cost savings. Those are kind of the three biggies. And again, aside from all of the constitutional arguments, pro and con, those three specific items. And I wanted to ask then, the first question is, I wanted to explore voter turnout. The proponents of this said that this would increase voter participation, meaning voter turnout. And the closest thing we could compare it to would probably be the last mayoral election, which would be 2005. And Mr. O'Connor, you said that, and I agree entirely, that you said how hot a campaign is, or how competitive, I guess would be my word, how competitive a campaign is leads to higher turnout. There's no question that's true. But how did, numerically, what was the specific turnout? I think you said somewhere, you gave a ballpark. But what was the voter turnout number this past election versus 2005? Do you know the numbers?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, I can approximate them, and we can certainly get you the accurate numbers. For this past municipal election in Minneapolis, we were just a little bit short of 46,000 voters, and that translated to approximately 19.8% turnout of registered voters. And that would be voters not only pre-registered but registering on election day. And as I said in my earlier testimony, that compares very favorably with the experience in St. Paul. They had approximately the same turnout. The previous mayoral election was a more contested race, and you may recall that it was, frankly, the lead race is, of course, the mayoral race in a city, and in that race, it was Mayor R.T. Ryback and Commissioner Peter McLaughlin, both well-known in the city of Minneapolis. They had approximately a 40% turnout at that race. The previous one to that was the mayoral race between Sharon Sales-Belton and R.T. Ryback, and that one had approximately 70% turnout. So we have seen in Minneapolis voter turnout drop drastically in the municipal elections.
Okay. Well, then, Madam Chair, my next question is for the political scientists here, and that is, if the claim is made that a particular proposal will increase voter participation, but yet the driving factor clearly is the competitive nature, how does a political scientist isolate a factor in knowing statistically whether or not something improves voter participation? Is that possible to do, and how would you do that?
Senator Gerlach, before he answers, Councilmember Gordon, if you'd like to join the table, I understand you are the chair of the Elections Committee for the City Council. We'd be happy to have your comments directly. But the question is for Professor Wagner or Robinson.
Either one. Scientist. He's a statistician.
Oh, okay. Well, either way, I guess how do you isolate it?
It actually involves both. Construction of a hypothesis and testing that hypothesis is always done with the aim of ruling out alternative explanations. So that's the question to how to rule out the candidates.
Senator, if you don't mind, from a statistics point of view, the way a person would determine whether something has a certain effect is to set up an experiment. You can't do that in a social science setting like an election. But in an ideal world, a person would have a hotly contested election with both types of voting and a less hotly contested election with both types of voting. If you only have two elections to compare and they differ on both those counts, it is impossible to separate out what caused the drop. I mean, it is possible that both are contributing. It is possible that one's contributing and not the other. But you'd have to have all four combinations of those factors represented in order to separate out.
Okay. Madam Chair, that's helpful. And so when proponents say that instant runoff voting or ranked choice voting will enhance voter participation, apparently it's impossible to know that you don't really know that's simply a matter of opinion and conjecture is what I'm hearing then. So,
Councilmember Gordon, would you like to respond to that? And if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
I would. My name is Cam Gordon. I'm city council member in Minneapolis for Ward 2. I'm also chair of the Elections Committee. I just wanted to raise one point because I have been an advocate for this form of voting for a number of years, and I do appreciate the case that can be made for improving voter participation. But I think the issue that we want to make and that people make isn't that it will necessarily improve voter turnout in any given general election. It will be that the decision will be made at a general election rather than at a primary. What we have had in Minneapolis in the past is a runoff primary where hardly anybody goes to vote, and then all the candidates have been eliminated but the top two. If you compare that amount of voters who participated in those runoff primaries with the number that participated in this general election, I think there is an increase, and there has been an increase. I will also add that voter turnout has been a persistent problem for decades in the city of Minneapolis. If you look at voter turnout back 50 or 60 years, there's been this steady decline. It's a problem that we have to deal with, and I don't think any of us expected ranked choice voting to reverse that in and of itself.
Senator Gerlach, you want to follow up on
Madam
that?
Madam Chair, on the next item, one of the claims made is that that there's less negative campaigning. That was quite mentioned quite a bit. Again, this is a question for the political scientist folks and the statistician, similar to my previous question, and that is, have you or anybody, or how do you quantify and statistically study from a political science or statistical perspective the negative campaigning, and how would we know if we've now had this experience with this type of voting, how would we know, proven, whether there was more or less or neutral negative campaigning? How could you approach that from to give us numbers?
Sure, we didn't do that as part of this job at all, but it's being done. It has been done quite regularly for some time nationwide. It's a matter of defining what is in that election or across the elections. What is negative? Is it a personal attack? Is it an attack that's not based on facts? It's something just made up. And then monitor, if it's a TV ads, radio ads, literature drops, that sort of thing.
Okay.
That wouldn't be that difficult. It's not that difficult to do.
Okay, Madam Chair, but that wasn't done as part of this study, and we have no data on that.
We didn't.
So we don't know, based on this past election, whether that claim was proven or disproven. We just don't know then on the negative campaigning side.
Right, and I asked at the beginning what their goals were and what their contracts were. Was and their contract to do the survey was not to, as far as I understood what they said, not to prove or disprove a particular claim about ranked choice voting, but to describe voter attitudes.
Okay. Right.
And there's a difference. I mean, now people can use this in the service of a claim or either in support or in opposition, but the report itself, it doesn't seem to me to, that was not their, the city didn't ask them to give them a hammer.
Right. No, I understand. Oh, Madam Chair, I have another question.
Mm-hmm.
The third main claim made was that there would be cost savings. And I was making some notes here, and I think, Mr. O'Connor, I think I heard you say that it was a wash. Did I pick up that correctly? Were there cost savings from this method, or was it the same? It sounds like you said it was a wash.
Mr. O'Connor.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlich, in this particular instance, I think I had said that the worst case would be that it would be a wash. It appeared that it would save some money. I think the controlling factor here for the city of Minneapolis in this particular election was that we had to hand count the ballots. Now, had the equipment been in place as it is for a traditional election, and had we not had that extra cost, it would appear at this point that there would have been savings from not having the primary election of more substantive amount.
Okay.
And you said, Mr. O'Connor, I think that the hand counting operation cost about $60,000.
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's the
dollar. Is that in excess of what you would have expected, or that's just that for that procedure?
Madam Chair, just for that procedure. That doesn't count the cost of the election judges, all the other election costs that are routinely incurred in an election. This is just, I guess I didn't mention this, we hired our chair and vice chair judges to be our counters, and the wages that we paid them for that period of the hand count totaled approximately $60,000. And we would avoid that if we had automated equipment.
Senator Gerlach?
Well, Madam Chair, but it sounds like there is no automated equipment on the horizon. The chair asked about that. There's nothing in the offing. So these cost savings then are theoretical, because nothing exists to alleviate those costs at this point in time. Is that a good, correct statement?
Mr. O'Connor?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, that's correct. Eminent, no. We're hoping, though, in the future that might be the case.
Okay.
Well, I think it's also the case that if I mean, they had a very, very low turnout, and the hand counting of that very, very low turnout was $60,000. If they had a contested race with more than two candidates in it, let's say at the a competitive race rather, for mayor, for this first time around, one would assume that the hand counting costs would have been significantly more. Mm-hmm. I would think
so. Yeah. Okay. Well, Madam Chair, then those are three key points that it sounds to me like on the voter turnout claim, in practice, we found that we don't know that that's certainly a minor impact, if any, and there's no way to measure it, that it's impossible to know, that the negative campaigning could be studied, but it wasn't done in this case, so again, we don't know, and that the cost was a wash, and as you said, it had been a higher turnout. I mean, so the cost savings weren't necessarily there. It's probably no surprise if you didn't know that I'm not a big fan of the system, but I wanted to follow up on those points and that. Now, my next question is determine which is correct on a discrepancy. I read in the paper somewhere, and I can't find the article now, and you can never find it when you're looking for it, but that the number of people that took advantage of this option to vote for a second or third choice on their ballot, that the number, this was right after the election, was less than half. And then statistically on the phone surveys, you said about 60% said that they had exercised that option. Now, a phone survey versus the reality might be different. So I'll ask, Mr. O'Connor, what was the statistic? How many voters actually used a second or third choice?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlich, I just can't remember the exact numbers, but I think that what we're able to determine from the machine count at the close of the polls on election night per race was how many people cast ballots in the first choice column, how many cast ballots in the second, how many cast ballots in the third choice column, and that gave us an indicator of drop-off. And it may have been that the newspapers were quoting, because those results were made available through the Secretary of State's office and as soon as we had them as well. The St. Cloud State folks, of course, got their information from the survey of voters and non-voters, and so with that, I'll let them respond.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlich, sometimes there's what we call a halo effect. If it's really 50%, it may, when we ask them, you know, that it may go up a little bit.
I understand that.
And in Minnesota, if you might remember a couple of years ago, Jesse Ventura was elected governor, I think with, 37%, something like that. Not too long after that election, we then asked the voters, when he was very, very popular, if they voted for him, and, you know, like everybody said yes.
Mm-hmm. I understand how that works. Well, when you ask people if they plan to go vote, they'll all say yes, because that's a good civic thing to do and that sort of a thing. So, but Eddie, the point is that somewhere around half, whether it's a little less than half or 60%, somewhere around half of the people who showed up chose not to exercise that option. They just chose one and walked away. So I think that's something that's important. A question for Mr. O'Connor, the postcard that was sent out from the city of Minneapolis. My question is, there's a number of four different public meetings. I'm just curious on what was the attendance at those meetings? How many people, these total, do you think, between the four meetings showed up to learn more about it?
Mr. O'Connor.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, we are very disappointed in the turnout at those meetings. We learned a lot in terms of education and outreach and what worked and what didn't, and I didn't go into that very much in my testimony here, but we can certainly do that at a later date. That was probably one of the least effective. What we found is if a meeting was already called, we were very welcome to come and address the group. But if a meeting was called specific for this purpose, we found attendance very poor.
But Madam Chair, do you know about how many people? I mean, we're talking 10 people, we're talking 1,000 people between the four meetings.
This is
kept attendance.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, we do have those attendance figures absolutely back in the office. If I were to hazard a guess right now, I think on average probably a dozen.
Oh, a dozen total? Citywide?
Yeah, for each of them.
About a dozen people. Okay.
I think you're referring to right at the end, just prior to the election, we held 14 community meetings in 14 days.
Okay.
And it was turnout at those meetings that was not as good as we had hoped.
Okay.
Mr. O'Connor, when the charter amendment was passed, or maybe Councilmember Gordon, what was the vote in terms of percentages of people, of voters that wanted to change the charter to allow ranked choice voting? Do you recall, either one of you?
Madam Chair, well, I believe it was about 65%.
65% yeah. Voted yes. Is
correct.
And do you need to vote on the item like you would on a constitutional amendment in order to have your vote counted as yes? What about people who didn't vote on the issue? Does the city count those as no votes, or are they just not counted?
They're just not part
just
of the
not
tabulation.
Counted. Okay. So it's different than when we have a constitutional amendment. It's not just everybody. You have to have one more than half in the entire voting population. It's only those people who voted on it, and it was 65% to 35%.
That's correct, Madam.
Okay. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next question I have is from the report. So this would be for the political science folks. And that is this: the key findings for the survey.
Could you tell us what page? Are you on page 7?
Page 7.
So I've got a summary.
I want to question the angle, I guess, because statistics, everybody knows, especially statisticians, can be used in many different ways. And when I read the key findings, I see a picture being painted with what appears to be a very positive picture. And I'm saying that because it's on the, for example, the bottom three, one half of candidates thought that this positively impacted their campaigns. Well, that means half said it didn't, or some variation of didn't. And then the next one, half of the candidates saw this as an advantage to political party. Well, then half didn't. So, I mean, you chose to put everything into the affirmative. Similarly, 50% of the candidates adjusted their campaign strategy due to this. Well, that means half didn't.
Yes.
Everything is half, 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 but yet you chose the one side. But the biggest point that I really wanted to point out, and then if you could comment on this,
I mean, there's a bunch of don't knows and no opinions.
Now, this is election judges. Is that correct? It's 70% of the respondent judges. This would be a group of election judges surveyed. Is that okay? The head's nodding. It says reported that they are very confident that the votes will be counted accurately. Now, that one jumps out of the page at me, and this is why. It should be the expectation and the assumption that all votes, I mean, these are our election judges. These are the people that are trained and that are in the field administering the election. And it says 70% of all respondent judges report that they are confident. So 70% think that what we expect should happen, but yet 30%, nearly a third, are saying that they're not confident. Nearly a third of our election judges are saying that they are not confident that the votes will be counted accurately. To me, the statistic of 30% is the new noteworthy key finding.
Senator Gerlach, goes against your argument, but if you look at Table 38, it really is only a quarter.
Well, no, I know
but
that,
but
that,
I mean, it's but still there's a huge number. There's still a huge number.
Yes.
If 25% of the election judges were either not entirely confident or not confident at all, and just throw out the 6% of the don't knows and rather not answers, that's still a huge number.
Yes, ma'am, sure, you're right. I mean, those are a couple percentage points there, but they're still not confident. Even if they answer.
No, I'm agreeing with you. I'm just saying it's a fourth. Even though it's only a fourth rather than a third, it's still a major point.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll go with the fourth then. But a huge number said they're not confident. And to me, that is a massively important key finding.
That is an indication of a huge problem. But yet, it says 70% think things are okay. Why is it that you chose? I want to be a little bit more aggressive on this because this one jumped out. Why didn't you point out the statistically significant, important matter and instead go with the 70% think things are okay?
A couple of reasons. One, if you look at Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, Table 38, it's a very small n. The not confident at all is 9%, but it's three individuals. It's not how it's done.
Well, Madam Chair, if it's such a small n or sample size has to be insignificant, then where the 30% results don't matter, then why is the 70% aboard?
Maybe that whole thing
then just tossed out if the sample size is so small as to not be reliable. I mean, if you can herald that 70% of this small sample size says this, but then the 30% is, you know, it's so small that it's, you know, insignificant. I'm just saying that this is a huge item on here, and it should say 30% who are not confident in that the votes of the public are not going to be counted. To me, that is the statistically significant key finding, not the 70%.
Well, Senator Gerlach, it would seem to me that, with all due respect, that none of it is statistically significant because the sample is so small.
Well, Madam Chair, it was mentioned as a key finding.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm saying that I wonder why, rather than just talking about percentages, that to indicate the fact that the sample was so small, it would be we talked to 34 people, and three of the judges were not confident, or four of the 34 were not confident or confident at all. So I would trust more those tables and findings where the sample size was 600.
Madam Chair, I don't disagree with that at all. I understand. I see it's a small sample size, and I know that. But the data is used in the report.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you. I think there's another point there, and it's not just the percentages, but it should have been. And maybe it is in the narrative that I have not looked at that indicates that the sample size for it was statistically insignificant.
That's a questions I had, mm-hmm. but I wanted to zero in on those two main topics, the claims of the advocates, mm-hmm. which statistically and we know from practice have a lot of problems, and then also statistically the results. It looks like around half of people actually only exercised the option, and there wasn't a lot of public interest in it, as we know from mm-hmm. the attendance, and then also the election judges themselves, you know, had some issues in it. And again, you know my position on the matter, but I wanted to bring those things to light for the record. And I just think it's been enormously valuable having folks here to talk about some of these numbers and how this played out.
Senator Gerlach, and for other members too, what I find interesting about this phenomenon is that the privilege that we give cities and counties that aren't charters to kind of run themselves within certain parameters, and that even if nobody else in the whole state wanted to, that's a charter city, wanted to move to ranked choice voting, that it was not against state law for Minneapolis to do that, and or now it looks like St. Paul. And yet there are opponents to it, and there were opponents to it before they even had the charter change. Would this be something that you would think that, irrespective of the charter that cities and counties have, that we should enact a law that says you may not use this form of voting regardless of how the people in your jurisdiction feel? Would this be an instance where this would be something outside of a charter that you would favor disallowing? And I'm interested in how, you know, what would be the grounds for not allowing this kind of change or any other kind of change in charters, and what would be the what would be a good reason to not allow a charter change, other than, you know, something like you can't change the criminal code or to suit your city or something. But
as a new metro, I think it's,
yeah, or anybody
simple.
But I'm curious, since you're an opponent of it, as a policy, I mean, if you had been a voter in Minneapolis for the charter amendment, you would have voted no. Now, should the state not allow cities to that are charter cities to even have the privilege of voting on a charter amendment that would allow ranked choice voting? And I'm not trying to be confrontational. I'm just curious.
Absolutely. Well, that's an easy one, because if it clearly violates the Constitution, then it shouldn't be allowed. And that's,
okay,
of
and
course, a point of debate. I believe that it does, but we didn't want to debate the whole issue of instrumental
voting.
No, but
they did, but it was challenged, and it wasn't, and it, their decision to have this charter amendment was accepted.
No.
And, you know, I don't New Hope is not a charter city, but Crystal is. And if I'd lived in Crystal, I don't know whether I'd vote for it or not on a charter amendment. But I don't know whether the state should have the right, if it is constitutional, to tell our city how, as a charter city, how to organize or not.
Oh, I'm sure that's why it's being litigated. The matter hasn't been settled. It's still being litigated and appealed, and I don't know where the case is exactly right now, but. But again,
I thought the issue had been settled.
No.
In terms of constitutionality of Minneapolis's charter amendment. Is that not the case?
As far as I know, there's no further appeals going on with our case. There may be other cases and something going on in St. Paul that I don't know about, Madam Chair. I could be.
And the case that was brought against the city of Minneapolis, at what level of appeal did it go? Supreme Court or
State
appeal
Supreme
court?
State Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court.
I guess I don't know the specific facts. I can't speak to that now, but I don't know. But But in answer to your broader question, if I believe that it violates the Constitution in the city, regardless of statutory or charter, you know, home rule, whatever, shouldn't be allowed to do that. But again, that's getting off way off the topic of these. I was looking to get a lot of the,
no, I understand. These,
the numbers and the facts about how this actually worked. So,
Mr. O'Connor, and then Senator Marty. Go ahead, if you had a response.
Thank you.
Observation, whatever.
Madam Chair, to comment on Senator Gerlach's questions, and I do appreciate them. They're the very questions we're asking as election administrators ourselves. I just want to point out that my appreciation to the City Council in Minneapolis that they provided the funds to go ahead with a survey of this type, and they then allowed us to release publicly that survey the minute we had received it as well. In the interest of providing information for this very sort of debate to go on. I think that that the City Council is to be commended for this action. Some of the questions, as was mentioned earlier, related specifically to election administration, and they will then be translated into election judge training. That one statistic popped out to me as well, Senator Gerlach. Where were those 30% during election training? Were they snoozing? And many of them, of course, were actually part of our count, and the feedback we got from the counters was very positive over their feedback. So we will use this survey to amend and improve our election judge training, and hopefully the other parts of it will encourage good policy discussion at all levels.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I wanted to say something pretty similar to what Mr. O'Connor did, and that is that I think the city was very wise to have this study done. I don't think the study actually gets to what Senator Gerlach is interested in showing that this is a bad or good thing. I think it showed that what happened worked and worked in a logical, rational way, and that it was people were able to be educated about it and so on. In terms of, Senator Gerlach, in terms of some of your comments about claims about whether this saved money or not, I happen to think from what I was hearing there that if they have the counting machines, the software, it will save money compared to a primary, though there are ways of having instant runoff voting that you still have a primary, which I think is envisioned when people talk about it at the state level. But on terms of some of your claims where you're saying, well, did it show that there was less negative campaigning? I mean, I think I can make an argument why when we talk about the candidate saying they changed their campaign strategy around this, the vast biggest reason for any of those changes is going to be if it's a competitive race or not. I don't think this instant runoff voting election showed how it works in a very tough competitive race. But I think there's good reason to believe that if people are trying to be second choice of voters, they're going to be less negative towards each other just because they want to pick up the votes of the other candidates for their second choices. So I think it could very well have a very strong impact on reducing negative campaigning. But this survey isn't getting at that, and this election wouldn't be a good one to study it with anyway because they were not, for the most part, they were not any kind of really tough competitive elections. So I think that your questions in the debate we're going to have on ranked choice voting is appropriate, but this survey, I think, is extremely helpful for showing what worked and what needs improvement and so on in ranked choice voting in Minneapolis, but I don't think it was intended to, nor would it have been able to show the kinds of questions you have about it.
Senator Gerlach,
On the survey, who paid for this? Was this commissioned from the City of Minneapolis? And did the City of Minneapolis pay them, St. Cloud State, to do this?
Or Mr. O'Connor?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, that's correct. The study was paid for out of the Election Department budget.
And how much did it cost, Mr. O'Connor?
$50,000, Madam Chair.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, just one comment on Senator Gerlach's concerns about the whether the votes are counted accurately or not. No election is ever conducted in a sterile environment or a vacuum. this particular election was conducted just a few months after we finally concluded the 2008 Supreme Court race that took from November to the end of June to decide. And so if there were some people that were skittish about, you know, accuracy in counting votes, it may have been a spillover from that election. I agree that there are concerns going into this particular one, but how do you separate them out? There may be other factors involved here. Maybe as time goes on and, you know, we have more opportunities to look at this, we'll have a better feel for whether it's working or not. So.
Thank you. Sir, Dr. Robinson.
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach and other senators, we let some discussion go on when there's a couple of typos, and we really apologize for our typos because it's our responsibility to get this right, but we use cut and paste. And so, Senator Gerlach, to your question on whether the election judges felt the votes were counted accurately, what it should read is 6 of 10 candidates. That's a section talking about the survey of candidates. So 70% of the respondent candidates reported they are very confident that votes will be counted accurately. That question was not asked of the election judges. I'm very sorry for the typo. It's our fault, and
should have
I'm very embarrassed about it.
Should have interrupted our discussion earlier, sir.
We tried to. We kept raising our hands.
I'm sorry.
We're looking at it, it's like, no, that's not, just not right. I'm looking at three individuals. Not
it's the evils of cut and paste when you're word processing. I'm very sorry.
Okay, we've made the correction. 70% of it should be candidates. 70% of the respondent candidates.
Okay.
That's what we've reflected in Table 38. Is that correct? Not election judges.
And the bullet, if you would, just above that, similarly, 6 of 10 candidates. It should all be candidates.
Okay.
Those two are
candidates. Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
If you're talking about typos, on page 7, you need to close your parentheses. You know, you know, like it says parentheses
as
table.
I've been staring at it. There's two of those, by the way.
Yeah, I know. So I closed it myself. So.
Yeah. Mr. O'Connor, and then we need to move on.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if I can talk to these guys about a refund of some of our money.
I see. thank you very much, gentlemen. Councilmember Gordon and Mr. O'Connor, Dr. Wagner, Dr. Robinson. I'm sure we
Thank
will
you.
Be referring to your study or survey later on. At this point, I'd like to invite Mr. Maida, the city clerk from Minnetonka, to talk about the electronic poll book pilot project in that city this year. And I hope that you will... First of all, and maybe that's what you're doing in your thing, tell us what an electronic poll book is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Maida. I'm the city clerk in Minnetonka. I've been the city clerk for about 3 years. Prior to that, I worked for Mr. O'Connor at Hennepin County Elections as a supervisor. To answer the first question, the electronic poll book, for you, if you're not aware of what that is, currently our rosters that you sign when you sign in to vote and before you receive your ballot, it's all done on paper. What this is it automates that process. It puts the data onto either a laptop or a portable piece of equipment that the voter signs before and attests to the oath, and then the judges give them a ballot. So it makes the paper process, it turns it into a more 2000s technology process. I'll begin by saying our pilot project in 2009 wasn't as newsworthy as what happened in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I think we did receive a nice write-up in the Star Tribune, and our local newspaper, the Lakeshore Weekly, did a very nice write-up too. Channel 11 sent out cameras to our polling places, but they ended up using the footage in a story with Minneapolis's ranked choice voting. So we did get some attention.
How did Minnetonka become the pilot project site or city?
One of the vendors we used was DataCard Corporation, DataCard Group. They're a Minnetonka-based corporation. They received a statewide contract in the state of Virginia to implement their product. They contacted me early in 2009 to see if we could send some of our election judges to go through the training that they're preparing for the state of Virginia. I've been aware of this technology for about 10 years. I've actually met with Data Card Corporation when I was with Hennepin County Elections, and I've always been impressed by the technology. So once I met with Data Card in the spring of 2009, I thought it might be something we could implement for our 2009 city election just as a pilot to see. And basically the purpose was to get input from our election judges and voters. My staff is always accusing me of being enthralled by the newest thing. Like I was the first one on my block to get a VCR. I stood in line in the first seat to get an iPhone. So I confess to that part of my personality. So part of the purpose of our pilot project really was for me to get a better sense of if our election judges thought it would be helpful to them in the polling place and if there was any reaction from voters in Minnetonka on using something like this. So that was kind of the motivation to do this.
So how much did it cost the city of Minnetonka?
It was entirely free. The vendors.
Let's get that set for that. To start with. Okay.
The vendors basically make three claims on the benefits of electronic poll books. It eliminates...
Excuse me, did you have to get permission from the Secretary of State's office to do this pilot project?
I didn't have to get permission, but I did go through them to see if they had any concerns or anything they wanted me to address as part of this pilot project. And we actually, Gary Poser, the election director, actually asked me to recreate a couple of our precincts from the 2008 primary before our city primary, so before we implemented it in a polling place, we saw if there was anything that might come up that we had to address. Okay. So it saves massive amounts of paper if we go this route. It has the ability to reduce the errors that our election judges sometimes make in our polling places. And the technology, in the long run, I believe, would save us some money, and we can get into that in my presentation. Currently, our process is for the rosters is very manual intensive. We get our rosters from the Secretary of State's office. The state prints them out. They send them to Hennepin County. Hennepin County then goes and separates all the rosters for all the cities in the county and the school districts. The county then ships them out to the city. We have to then separate them by precinct to make sure they go to the right precinct, and I've made that mistake in an election, sending the wrong roster to the wrong precinct. That's not a good thing to do, and we'll avoid that in the future. So it's a very manual process. We have to do all this shipping and manual separation of paper, and then after the election, the judges bring the rosters back to the city. The city then sends them back to the county. The county then, by law, has to process all the information within 42 days, and once the county is done processing the information, they actually send it back to the city to store for 22 months. So we still have rosters for that any election from the past 22 months. And in Minnetonka, it's about, currently the rosters have about 13 voters per page, and we have 35,000 registered voters in our city. So it's about 2,700 pages of rosters that we have for every election, no matter what the turnout is. And the previous discussion talked about low turnout. In our 2009 city election, we actually only had a 13% turnout, which is much lower than we've ever had before. Again, it goes back to we had an unopposed mayor race, and the two city council members were incumbents that won, and they won by quite a bit. So I think there wasn't a lot of competitive races in our election this year. So we would save quite a bit of paper if we went to the statewide or even Hennepin County. If Hennepin County used a system, there'd be quite a reduction in the use of the amount of paper that we'd be required to use. The purpose of our pilot project in 2009, I mentioned before, basically was to get feedback from our election judges and voters. I really wanted to see if our judges, if they had any concerns about using computers or any concerns about the technology itself, and I'll report right away. Every judge I showed this to just wanted me to buy it right away. I mean, they really thought it would improve their ability to handle some of the situations that come up in our polling places. It was unanimous. I mean, we did trainings prior to using them in elections, and again, the question I got asked immediately is, when can we have this? And so we actually limited it. We have 27 precincts in the city. We just used two of our precincts. We had two vendors come forward, Data Card Group, who I mentioned before, kind of initiated this. And then when Election Systems and Software, who manufactures the voting equipment we use in our city, heard about the pilot project, they asked if they could participate too, so we used their product in another precinct. So we had two precincts involved. Another motivating factor for me was I discovered through this process that in 1985, our city was actually the first one to use optical scan voting in the state. There was a pilot project in 1985, and I don't know how it was before my time, but how it occurred, but Minnetonka was chosen to use the optical scan voting technology that's used everywhere in the state right now for the voting part of the process. So once I discovered that, I thought, let's continue the tradition of Minnetonka being innovative, and so we continued with our pilot project. The unfortunate part of the pilot project was, again, we had a very low voter turnout for our election in 2009. It was 13% citywide. The two precincts I chose to use, precinct Ward 1, precinct B, has 2,000 registered voters. They had 243 voters that day. Mm-hmm. Precinct Ward 1, precinct C, has about 1,800 registered voters, and they only had 81 people vote that day. So
81?
81. So we did not get a very robust test of this technology, I'll admit up front. But again, it gave our judges in each of those precincts, and we rotated shifts in the precincts so as many of our election judges as possible could get a chance to use the technology and give feedback on it. And again, it was unanimous. Well, with the exception of one election judge who had concerns about the city proceeding and paying for basically two or three laptops in every precinct, the cost of that. That was that election judge's concern. Besides that one concern, I mean, the election judges just loved the technology. What it does is the paper, it may not seem intuitive that it's that much quicker to look somebody up on a computer than it is to flip through roster pages, but it really is. I mean, you just type in part of the voter's name, and then you can find the voter. It also eliminates a situation where somebody comes in that's registered to vote, the judges have a hard time finding it. With an electronic poll book, much as any computer search, you can search by different criteria. So you can search on all the registered voters that live at a specific address to find a voter that way. You can type in the birth date and pull up voters that way. So it gives the judges a tool that they can, if they have trouble finding someone in the poll, in a roster, it gives them the ability to search another way.
Why would they have trouble?
A lot of the mistakes.
Understanding the spelling of someone's name or something like that? Or what?
Madam Chair, another benefit of this technology is the errors that get made in our rosters in the current system a lot of times are data entry errors. The county is the one entering all the information into the state voter registration system. They're depending on the clarity of the handwriting on the voter registration form to data enter. And at Hennepin County, they rely heavily on temporary employees to do a lot of the data entry. So you're only as good as the data entry person, and that person is only as good as the clarity of the handwriting. So a lot of data entry errors do get made. And for the most part, those are easy to find on a paper roster because, I mean, it might be a misspelling of Johnson missing an H, for example, and you would still see it on the same page. But if you read Johnson as Bonson, it would be in an entirely different part of the roster, and you wouldn't be able to find that person. So a lot of the errors that this technology would find are based on data entry type errors. And in the end run, what we get is an electronic file, so you don't get all the need to read, interpret people's handwriting. So it's a cleaner system
for the data. Excuse me, Mr. Maeda. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Maeda, maybe you're going to get to this, but so where does the voter sign make their signature then that they would normally do in the poll book?
Mr. Maeda.
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, the technology allows for different options. The way we did it for our pilot project was we printed out a voter receipt once the voter checked in. It had all the voter information on it, and they signed the receipt. The technology also allows for, similarly to the technology you see in a grocery store or any other retail establishment where you sign an electronic signature pad, we could go that route if that's the way we chose.
And then, Madam Chair, Mr. Maeda, then the computer stores a copy of the signature, obviously.
Correct.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
You know, as I listen to this, and I certainly do believe that decreasing the length of lines and having voters go through efficiently is important. But wouldn't we be able to get the same benefit if each voter handed an identification card to the election judge and they didn't have to guess on the spelling of names, or didn't have to guess on birthdays, or didn't have to guess, you know, if somebody has a bit of an accent, wouldn't have to try and guess on pronunciation. I think that would also speed up voting, would it not, if somebody had that instead of a verbal, what's your name?
Mr. Maeda.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I believe, well, two answers to your question. A lot of our election judges are let's say, above the age of 50 and might have hearing issues. And to be handed something is one way to clarify, define in the roster. So, yes, it would speed things up if the election judges have something in front of them that they can look up. The other part of this that I haven't touched on yet is the election day registration part. The election day registration requires ID at this point in our process. And the system we use, the data card system we use, was really, really what I ended up the most impressed by in this entire pilot project, because the way it worked was a voter could bring in their driver's license, we'd swipe it, it automatically fills out a voter registration form, so it takes all the information on the driver's license and it completes the voter registration application for the voter. And I mean, it sped that process up tremendously.
Madam Chair.
Senator Seaman.
To Senator Roebling's point, however, if you handed a voter, if you handed the poll worker your driver's license and there was a data entry error, however, that still wouldn't be caught. I mean, like, it would still be a problem if your last name was entered as Bonson, like you said, instead of Johnson. You know, yeah, that still wouldn't help that situation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
They'd then have a birth date without even asking for it, and they could look it up another way, and somebody wouldn't have to hear that conversation take place as well. Be more private for the voter.
But
Senator Seaman?
Madam Chair and Mr. Maeda, there's no prohibition now. A voter can hand their driver's license to a election official if they so choose. Is that correct?
Mr. Maeda?
Madam Chair, Senator Stephen, that is correct, and it happens a lot. I mean, a lot of our voters come into the polling place and they automatically just hand some type of identification to the election judges.
Okay, go ahead. Oh, Senator Marty, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, did you need special permission to do this or from the state, or are you just allowed to do this? I mean, can other cities use this?
Mr. Maeda.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty again, we did not need, by statute, we didn't need permission to do this because the systems itself actually met all the statutory requirements. I did contact the Secretary of State prior to going ahead with this to see if they had any concerns.
Keeping in mind that one of the first questions I asked also, Senator Marty, was that this was a pilot project on behalf of the private company and did not cost the taxpayers of the city of Minnetonka in these two precincts anything at all. They were looking for a way of demonstrating what they were doing in the state of Virginia in Minnesota as to, I'm sure, something for the future. I mean, I think it's a, maybe I'm not as big a geek as Mr. Maeda, but I think it's a very exciting thing for the future. And although photo ID remains a controversial and partisan, turns out, controversy, I think that the technology in the electronic poll books represents at least a beginning bridge between people who hate photo ID and people who think it is the only way to guarantee integrity in an election. So that kind of starting common ground for those two polar positions, I think it's very encouraging myself.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rolstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having heard the testimony from Minneapolis and your testimony, I think I'm more concerned about off-year elections. I mean, 19% and I mean, that's those are dismal.
Just voter turnout?
Yeah.
Well, you can also say that the city of Minnetonka, I don't know even at this point the name. I've known Minnetonka mayors before, but I don't know who it is. If no one chose to run against that person, the people must have been generally pleased with their performance. And I don't see us going to the Australia mode and requiring people to vote, and if you don't vote, you get fined $50. That is not part of our election culture, that even though voting is a privilege and a right and responsibility, no one requires you to exercise it.
Madam Chair, along those lines, though, it would be more efficient, if you're talking about saving money, if all the elections were coordinated at the same time, like school districts elections moved to the fall when many of them used to be in the spring, and township elections.
But we did do that, yeah.
Right.
I think the one that's not required in the fall is the townships.
Correct.
Isn't that correct? Otherwise, they all are on the general election day. Yep. Mr. Maeda, you want to continue? And members, I think we will. I want to respect members' time, and although we started a little bit late, I think we will end with Mr. Maeda's presentation, and you have the bill and a draft of the summary. It hasn't changed since it was introduced. So the purpose of the bill is just to regularize the procedures under which a ranked choice voting election would be held if a charter city or county adopted it. And what those procedures are, there may be improvements in them. Mr. Mansky thinks we should wait until St. Paul does its research before we move to that, and that might be the sentiment of the committee as well. But I wanted you to have that before you. But let's finish up the hearing today with just hearing from Mr. Maeda, unless anybody has a burning desire to have me present the bill. There's unanimous consent. We're gonna hear more from Mr. Maeda.
Madam Chair, just 2 points. For the record, our mayor is Terry Schneider.
Mary Schneider?
Terry Schneider.
I'll remember that.
And to Senator Marty's question, one of the things we also did in our pilot project, we didn't use the poll book as a standalone. We also continued using the paper roster. So the voter essentially signed the roster while at the same time the electronic poll book was used. One of the benefits we've already kind of touched on is one of the reasons we get lines at polling places is the process of signing in. And one of the benefits to the electronic poll books is if we have two of them in a polling place, we're used to right now breaking up our rosters by the alphabet, as you're probably all aware. So we might break our rosters in from voters whose last names begin A through K, L through P, and Q through Z. So if you happen to arrive at the polling place at the same time, Senator Rest, if you were to arrive at your polling place at the same time, a family of S's, where your line might be 20 people long and the other two lines might be zero. So you're standing in line waiting for the check-in for that particular poll book or roster to be used. The electronic poll books, we can put the entire roster on each laptop or device. So essentially it can be like a bank where you're standing in one line, and as soon as the next available election judge becomes free, you can just go up to them and sign in. So it's not specific. We don't have to break them up into the alphabet anymore. So that reduces the amount of waiting in line that happens at a polling place. And our election judges really like that. The last thing our election judges really like is at the end of the night when we close up the polling place, they have to reconcile all the numbers. So they count up the number of signatures on the roster, the number of voter receipts that were issued that day, and that has to match the total number of ballots that are in the ballot box. Oftentimes we're off by one or two, and there's reason for that happening. But one of the primary reasons is it's very difficult after you've worked all day at 9 o'clock at night having to count signatures on a roster, it's very easy to miscount something or just make a human error. What the electronic poll book does is it keeps track of the number of voters as soon as they sign in. So we can run reports throughout the day that show the number of people that have signed the rosters, and the election judges can check throughout the day to make sure that number reconciles with the number showing on the tabulator. So there's less of a chance for that number to get off throughout the day. Our process in Minnetonka is if the numbers don't reconcile at the end of the night, we don't want our election judges struggling in the polling place trying to figure out what happened. So we have them, when they come back to City Hall, we have them actually sit down with our finance staff. Our finance staff sits down with the election judges and they go through all the numbers. They recount signatures, they recount voter receipts. They try to find out why the numbers don't reconcile, and we don't allow the judges to leave City Hall until the numbers reconcile or there's a reasonable reason. And often, I'll just, as a side, say one of the most common reasons numbers get off is if we have a jammed ballot at some point during the day. The judges aren't always sure whether or not that ballot counted, so they might count that ballot, put that ballot in again. If it's been counted, it might get counted twice, unfortunately, or they might think it's already been counted, so they'll just put it in the ballot box without it getting counted. Another unfortunate situation, but that causes the numbers to get off from the number of people that signed to the number of ballots in the ballot box. So while that problem won't go away, hopefully the judges, if they see a ballot jam, can then check the electronic poll book to see the number, see if the numbers match, and then it will help them determine what to do with situations like that. From an election administration point of view, I think one of the things we touched on earlier, or I touched on earlier, was the electronic data part. At the end of the night, what I can do is generate an electronic file for Hennepin County. I can send them the file to upload into the Secretary of State's voter registration system, and this reduces greatly the amount of data entry work the county would have to do. It would not eliminate totally. You still need someone to make sure that the information ties in with the correct voter record. But when I worked at Hennepin County, we used 30 to 40 temporary staff after every election to do all the data entry work. I think that number could be great. I mean, you could essentially use the county staff to do all the data entry checking that would be needed. As part of this pilot project, I didn't want to make the Secretary of State do any extra work, so we didn't do this part of the process. The file structure that the two vendors produced at the end of the night, the product, the file, wasn't capable of being uploaded into the state system, so we didn't actually do the electronic transfer. If we move forward with this, I think it's an important piece that we need, and I think Hennepin County is interested in this technology simply for that reason. I think in the long run, it saves them the most money out of anybody. As a city clerk, we try to staff our polling places as best we can with the election judges. We know that people tend to vote before they go into work, so we're fully staffed at 7 a.m. in the morning when the polling place is open. But it's hard for me to know from particular polling places when the actual flow of voters is. One of the great things about this technology is it really gives me hard data. I can run reports at any time showing how many people vote in a specific precinct anywhere in the city. And if long term, I'd be able to analyze, do I need to staff up in this polling place to deal with a crush of voters that get off it from one of our companies in the city and go vote.
Do the electronic poll books indicate what time someone signs the roster?
Madam Chair, it's capable.
Is there a date stamp on it?
It's capable of doing. It keeps a complete audit log of everything that occurs on that piece of equipment. So, again, it would really help me. And I think long term, I could actually reduce the number of election judges we use, because one of the comments I heard from our city council in this past election was with a 13% turnout, when he went to vote in his polling place, he saw six of our election judges essentially doing nothing. And he asked me, can't we give them utility bills to stuff or do some city work? And unfortunately, we don't know what the turnout's going to be, so we don't want to get them into other work, only have them not be able to do the other work. So unfortunately, my answer to him was no. But it would give us better information on how many election judges we actually need throughout the day in any polling place. And with that, I think I'll wrap up my comments. I will note, you have my PowerPoint presentation in front of us, and my last slide was kind of a joke. But one of the benefits is it leads to less grumpy election officials coming home at the end of the day because things tend to go smoother, I would argue. So my cats were very happy in the 2009 election to see me coming home singing the praises of this technology.
Are there questions or further comments for Mr. Maeda? And I will call on you in a minute. And thank you for making what might have been a very dry presentation actually very, very, very interesting. And I am very excited about the prospect in the future. Who knows at what point where more jurisdictions can take advantage of the increases in technology that lead to accuracy, the whole notion of the integrity of the voting experience and the satisfaction of the voters, the election judges, and candidates. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I echo the chairwoman's comments about your the lightheartedness of the presentation. I appreciate that, too. It was fun. I have a question about the technology itself. Would the cities, in this case, would you be able to use existing laptops that you have, or how do you, and if that's the case, I see you nodding, then how do you ensure the integrity of that equipment? You know, would it be handled and would it need to be locked up just like the ballots are locked and secured after, and how do you envision that happening
Mr. Maeda.
In the future?
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, that's a very good question. Currently, my thought is the next step for the city of Minnetonka is I'd really like to implement the election day registration piece of this because I really think that's the benefit we'd see. So I'm working with our IT staff on coming. We calculate we need about 24 laptops to use because we have a couple. We have 27 precincts in the city. Some of our precincts share a polling place, so in those situations, they could just use one laptop. So we have 24 laptops we need. Coincidentally, we have 24 laptops that are on our replacement schedule this year. So I have asked the IT staff to put those laptops aside. Both vendors' technology can be loaded on any laptop. The security issue is one we've really thought about, and I, working through these issues with my IT staff, I really think we dedicate these laptops specifically for the poll books. We would not use them anytime during the year for any other project. We'd strip the laptop down so it doesn't even have internet connection because it doesn't need internet connection, so there'd be no capability of hacking into the laptops. We'd keep them locked up in our election area so that it wouldn't have any access to it. So security is one issue we're working through. As far as delivering it to the polling place to use, I've also thought about that. And I think the way I would proceed doing that is we'd load the information on the poll book, and then we'd have the head election judge come in probably the day before the election to pick up and keep the laptop with them.
Senator Marty, or Senator Sieben. Yep. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, just a quick question. This sounds really promising, and I'm glad you're looking at the security and other issues, but if the vendors had not paid for it, you state that you think it'll produce overall cost savings. I can see that it might, but do you have quotes on what it would cost and that's what you're basing it on?
Mr. Maeda.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, that was a very hard number for me to get the vendors to commit to. I have seen in the state of Virginia that DataCart implemented their system. The cost of each poll book was about $800 per poll book. I think if we bought it off the shelf, it would range closer to $2,000 because we also have to buy some type of scanning device and some type of printer and then the software to load on there. So I think it ranges anywhere from $800 to $2,000. And so at one of the
for
next...
Each laptop to be operational.
Correct.
Is that what
you're saying? Yes. One of the next steps I'm working with the county on is trying to do some return on investment analysis to see how quickly this technology would actually pay for itself.
But, Madam Chair, your expectation when you were talking about the data entry at the county and paper and the time of election judges and everything, your sense is right now it would save money. You're not sure.
Mr. Maeda.
Madam Chair, Senator Murray, that's correct.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I would be most concerned about because of all my trouble with printers is having having those functioning throughout a very busy day, and you'd almost have to have a backup or something there to get the receipts printed out.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, again, those are issues we're working through. We definitely would have backup equipment available if we went forward with this. I think the ultimate backup is for the first couple of elections anyways, I would envision having at least the paper roster as a backup for if we have total system failure, we then could continue voting, of course. So we wouldn't just implement this blindly. We would make sure we have steps in place to make sure that our voting process doesn't get interrupted.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you again, Senator Gimsey.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could for just a moment.
Sure.
I'm very intrigued by the technology part of this and the your ability to swipe, say, a driver's license and create a registration from that. Do you also conceive that or believe that we could sign in using that type of, say, a biometrics of some type, say it was a photo ID or a driver's license, identification card, or even a voter registration card that had biometrics on it?
Mr. Maeda?
Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, Data Card Group actually that's their line of business. I mean, they produce much of the credit cards that are on the market currently, they are the manufacturer of. They also are very much into security badges. I'm sure if I asked them to do that, they would, actually. I mean, look into it. I think there are capabilities of this technology that actually kind of scare me because, I mean, basically it can go anywhere at this point that we want them to go. I mean, the vendors are very anxious to develop products that help us, and if we make suggestions like that, I think they could develop that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Maeda, thank you for your service to the City of Minnetonka, and I know there are other election officials here, and I want you to know how much all of our constituents appreciate the work you do all throughout the year, but certainly at the time of elections. Senator Betzel.
Just a quick question, Mr. Maeda. You said you were one of the first ones who bought a VCR. Did you choose Betamax or VHS?
Betamax.
Oh, okay.
Uh-oh. Thank you very much for your attendance today. It was a very interesting hearing, and there being no further business, the committee stands adjourned.
Okay. See, those are the questions you got to ask, right? Yeah. I mean, that was a better format, you know. It was technically superior. How did that work out? Because nobody.
I remember, and I could walk in.
Can I buy a VHS tape?
So. And actually, I think ultimately it works out better.
And I knew that. I thought of that after that conversation.
Yeah.
I knew there was a
reason.
It wasn't
like
this.
10 years ago,
they have both,
guy that was
that,
really
both those two bills on their agenda for Friday.
I got to get a computer with an A drive.
So John's question is,
what? The hard disk.
Yeah, because then you don't have to do it.
Yeah, the 3.5 is the A drive.
Wow.
What?
Hey,
yeah.
Someone else
will do it. Works for me.
I have an answer for a thing you mentioned.
Cutting the ribbon. And didn't mention.
No.
I thought about it.
I haven't yet.
Oh, yeah.
Spend money.